It's quite a journey we're on. Volume? Can you hear me? No. Volume?
Yes.
Okay. I forgot about the switch. It's quite a journey we're on here. And I don't just mean the retreat. This that we call being alive. This being human. This being what it is that we are. It takes a little while, it seems, to start to understand. To start to see clearly. To find what it is that truly serves our lives. Perhaps at the heart of much of what goes on is the fact that we care deeply about the condition of our hearts, our minds. We care deeply about the condition of others. And we care deeply about the world in our own way. Each of us. And yet, we don't necessarily find so easily the way to live from that caring, to live from that deep concern and love that we have. And this is quite understandable, this is quite human, we could say. And I think it arises to a large degree because we become entangled with the kind of the fundamental dynamic of our human experience, of what it means to be human, which is essentially to be vulnerable, to be sensitive, to be subject to being touched by life, touched by experience. Touched by others and by circumstances or situations. And in that process of being touched, we also notice we respond. That there's something that receives, that is impacted, that is affected. And there's this responsive capacity. There's this sense of a movement that arises within us. That we are learning to handle skillfully, to direct in a way that is wholesome, that is wise, and that contributes to the well-being we seek for ourselves and that we seek for each other and our world. To be alive is to be touched by life, to be affected, to be impinged. And what happens, and we've talked some about this, is we easily become lost in trying to control the experience of being affected, impinged, touched upon, to get comfortable, to stay within what feels safe. And yet we've seen that it's not possible. We've reflected on this. Perhaps we're still not quite convinced that if we just did it a little bit better, a little bit harder, a little bit more, whatever it is, that then things could be comfortable for our body and for our mind. Security is mostly what counts as comfort for the mind. But if we reflect on the deep degree of human sensitivity, we might come to understand how unlikely it is, and perhaps we could say how impossible it is, to create the conditions in which we're not affected or impinged upon. It's like as human beings we have only a limited capacity to handle things. From one perspective, at a bodily level, you know, we can only exist within a certain range of temperature. I think, you think in terms of centigrade here, is that right?
Celsius.
Good, Celsius, because that's the only one I can think of. I can't do the other one. You know, as human beings, we're comfortable from, I don't know, maybe about Well, in England, I would say from about 18 to 26 centigrade. Over here, you're probably comfortable, I'm guessing, from more like 20 to 28. Yeah? If it gets much colder than the 20 or the 18, we start to, you know, we start go looking for extra clothes. If it gets much hotter than 28 or maybe 26, we start looking for shade, for shelter, for air conditioning. You know, it's kind of a relatively small band when we think about the fact that the coldest temperature there can be is minus 273. That's cold. And the hottest temperature, I don't think there's a top end on the hot, but as far as what you find in the relatively near universe, you know, the core of an exploding, of a sun like ours, it's, you know, tens and millions of degrees. So it's, when you think of the little band that we're comfortable in, it's really small, isn't it? Compared to minus 273 to plus 10 million or something like that. Yeah? And we're good from 18 to 24, 26. You know? You kind of get a sense of, oh, that's interesting, isn't it? No wonder we spend a lot of time trying to get it comfortable, because the possibility of uncomfortable is wide. And of course, if we take it a little closer inside into our body, we know perhaps that the body is healthy and happy at around 37 degrees. We can go half a degree either way, and it doesn't feel too bad. You go 1 degree, it feels bad. You go 2 degrees, it feels really bad. If at the core of your body it goes 3 or 4 degrees, from 37, you're dead. I'm dead, if it happens. And you're as, oh, no wonder we're really concerned about this. No wonder. And again, we see it. It's really lucky we came here. We turned up in a body here, in this particular place, because a lot of places would be too cold or too hot. We just wouldn't survive a moment. So we can see and perhaps understand then, of course, it makes sense that there would be some real concern with this. With this taking care of our sensitivity, but we might also recognize that maybe we're not going to be able to prevent ourselves being impinged upon and impacted in these ways. The body is just one thing, of course. The mind, likewise, our emotional feeling sense that we can call our heart, and our mind is equally sensitive and vulnerable and touched in so many ways. There's a story that, for me, expresses it rather beautifully in Japan, it's probably just a story, but let's pretend it really happened. So sometime in the years past, in the Middle Ages, this samurai warrior walking along a dusty path, and he's a spiritual warrior. He's very deeply concerned with his life and what is important and true. And he's asking deep questions as he walks along. And then he sees this little monk sitting cross-legged on the side of the road. And he thinks, ah, I can ask my question to the spiritual. He comes up to the, says, "Monk, you are a holy man. Can you tell me the difference between heaven and hell?" And the little monk looks up at the big samurai warrior. He says, samurai, your clothes are dirty. Samurai, it looks to me like your sword is rusty. You haven't washed for some time, and samurai, you smell bad. Why should I talk to you?" And the proud warrior, he sees this little pipsqueak insulting him. He pulls out his sword, and he's just about to take the monk's head off with one blow. The monk's looking at him. He says, "That's hell." And suddenly, the samurai realizes what's happened. This little monk has just risked his life to show him what hell is. That to hear a few words and be willing, in breach of all of his code of honor as a samurai, to kill a defenseless person in that way, to be so angry, so filled with rage, he would do such a terrible thing, to see this as hell, and this little creature, this little being, has risked his life to give him this lesson, and he's filled with appreciation, with gratitude, with just love for this monk who's taught him something so important. And he's beaming down, smiling. The little monk looks up, he says, "That's heaven." For me, it's a lovely story about how we experience both that the hell and the heaven that we can know in this life when our heart is open and when our heart is closed. And of how sensitive we are, that a few words can touch us in such a way. And we know this, perhaps. We know how we can be impacted by a kind word to have our hearts lifted, and by a harsh word to feel hurt deeply. And here on the retreat, we are turning towards our experience, opening in to our experience again and again. And the level of sensitivity that becomes available, that we start to become aware of, becomes perhaps more, perhaps notice more clearly how sensitive we are. And we're more open and, in a way, vulnerable than we might have allowed ourselves to be. Perhaps for some time, perhaps more than we ever remember or since we were children, to allow ourselves to really be touched by experience. And to allow this to happen, there needs to be a safety for us. And there is a safety in our shared agreement in being here, in the way that we are. And it's really, that's part of why it's really important that we keep the silence, that we don't engage with each other, because even a kind or a harmless few words we might think may impact someone in a way that's not actually supportive for them. Or it may be fine for the person we direct it to, but someone else may be affected and we don't realize it. So this human sensitivity is something that's very much being explored in the context of practice and really supported by all of our respecting and holding with real care, with a real kindness for each other and ourselves, that sense of being here respectfully, holding the silence and allowing each of us to be here equally in that way, where we don't seek to impact each other. And yet, what we also see is that we need to understand what happens for us in the process of being affected, in the process of being impacted. That often what we have is an association with it, of born of our history, actually, that if we can't handle what comes, we will somehow be annihilated. Somehow it will overwhelm us, and it derives or arises from the experience that we all have as very small infants or children, but certainly as babies, where if we're not helped and supported to handle the experiences that come to us, sometimes there will be more than we can handle, and the effect of it is almost like to put too much electricity through the circuits of our mind and our heart, and it's like blow the fuse. So we actually lose our sense of our existence, our relationship, our contact, our presence, in a way that as a very small infant is deeply distressing and in fact terrifying. And we carry with us a memory of what it is like to be overwhelmed, because it happens for us all, no matter how wonderful the parenting we received was. And for some of us, our parenting wasn't, the parenting we received wasn't always just as we would wish it to be. And so there are this way in which we move in life with this sense of, or this fear, or this hesitancy about fully engaging, about fully opening, because there's this fear that we will be overwhelmed by. And it leads to that tendency to pull away, to hold back from, to easily anticipate that what will come to us will be more than we can handle. And it's interesting to reflect sometimes, you know, how much of our life have we spent trying to avoid what we fear? How much of our life involves a pulling back from, a withdrawing from, a kind of a closing down from that which scares or that which seems threatening or dangerous? Now, it's not to say that there isn't something wise about protecting or taking care where there is actual danger. But so much of the time, it's actually a process that takes place much more in our mind. You know, I don't know if you notice the what happens sometimes in the walking meditation. Find a nice shady place to do the walking. You start walking and then the sun moves and the shady place moves and we sort of move the walking place into the shady place. And in one level, that's okay. I would do the same. But we can sometimes be almost afraid of going into the place where it's hot. And why is that? A little bit of sun probably doesn't harm us. We need to be careful not to have too much, of course. That's wise. That's intelligent. But often we can have the sense of, if I go into the sun, then I'll get too hot, then I'll have a heat stroke, and then we can imagine we are taken to hospital and then, oh, it's very sad, you know, too much sunshine and walking meditation, all the relatives gathering, oh, I said they shouldn't go to that meditation retreat, you know, I was worried what would happen. Our mind moves so quickly towards a worst case scenario. Huh? You know that phrase? Like, how bad it could possibly be if all the worst things happen. And then we don't even let ourselves stand in the sun for 2 minutes. Just in case. Just in case. And our world gets smaller. Our world gets smaller and smaller and smaller. And interestingly, that very experience of the fear of what might happen if is really deeply painful to us. The American poet and author and philosopher Mark Twain, he once said, almost all of the worst experiences of my life never actually happened. When we imagine what will happen, the imagining is actually really painful and scary. And often it's in that that we experience more disconnection and difficulty than when actual difficulties happen. Because when something happens, we can respond to it. When we're anticipating, when we're imagining, believing it will, we can't really deal with it. We can't really handle it because it's not here. And so what we need to understand with fear, and this is really important, it's not that there isn't a place for caution, of course. Caution is in the presence of actual danger. If you're walking on the road and you hear the sound of a car, it's good to look and see, is there a car coming? Because there may be danger. We could just go, hearing, being mindful of hearing. Oh, fear, being mindful of fear. Yes. Oh, pain. No, obviously we're not suggesting that, yeah? We're not suggesting that. But often actually, we're not on the road. We're quite some distance from the road and we hear the car coming. And when I was a teenager, I was being, as teenagers can be, with some friends, rather foolish, playing with some motorcycles and we were, anyway, seeing who could get out of the way of the motorcycle and, the motorcycle would come towards one of us and it'd sort of stand there for a while and then jump to the side. Huh? On one occasion, I jumped to the side at the same moment the guy, the friend on the motorcycle decided he better miss me and turned that way. And so we hit. And, I flew through the air. He flew through the air. I was quite proud that I damaged the motorcycle quite a lot. And I hurt myself a little. But what's interesting is whenever I hear a motorcycle now, my whole body goes, will I be run over? Even if I am a long way from the road, even if I'm inside a building, and there's no motorcycle in the building with me. So many times we get programmed in that way that we act as if we're in danger when we're not. And what we need to do is to look and see actually what's happening here. Because what's happening is the fear. And the fear is happening in the present. The story of I'm going to be hurt, it's going to be bad, this is going to happen, that story is in the future. And what we actually need to do is come back into the body to feel what it's like that fear arises, to notice how it tends to clench or tighten or contract, and the way that that actually becomes a deeply painful experience that we think is the thing we're afraid of, is caused by the thing we're afraid of. Sorry. You see, we think this experience is being caused by the dangerous thing that might happen, But it's not. It's being caused by the fact that we don't see the fear for what it is. And we believe the story of what might happen, or we become lost in it. So coming back into the body, coming back into the feeling with some kindness, with some friendliness, to just check and see, is it okay for me here right now? Because the truth is, we cannot avoid being impacted. We can't separate ourselves from life. And in fact, when we try to, the very withdrawing, the pulling in, the tightening, the hardening, that becomes our deeper pain. That becomes our deeper suffering. When we allow ourselves to just start to feel into those places that we tighten, when we start to have the courage then to stay maybe and see what happens if I let myself feel this discomfort, if I stand a little in the sun and see, is this dangerous to me? Despite the fact that everyone will tell me I'm crazy if I stand in the sun. Only mad dogs and Englishmen stand in the sun. You have this phrase? So Englishmen do it because there's no sun in England. Or very little, so it's very rare to get enough that it could cause you any harm. But this sense of, can I open to? Can I open to? This actually, as we start to do this, our world starts to get larger. This is part of why we practice in this way. Our world becomes larger. And when we don't have the courage to do this, our world becomes smaller too, and we become imprisoned within the narrowness and the tightness and the contraction of the fear. And we can even feel it in our body as a hardening, a tightening, a numbing of our experience. And the very process of the practice of coming back into contact with what we feel begins to slowly soften and open that hardness, so that we actually begin to be able to feel the fullness and depth of our lives once again. So one of the things we need to contemplate, we need to reflect on in this way, to be able to both meet our experience, but also to hold ourselves in this in a way that's skillful, in a way that's kindly, in a way that allows us to bring kindness and care to touch our own hearts, our own bodies, our own minds, and our lives, is to understand there's a way in which we very easily come to believe that the difficulties of our life are somehow our fault. That those things that are challenging are somehow there because we have failed to do it the way we should have done it. And somehow, therefore, something is wrong with me. Something is not okay with me. It's a story we can tell about ourselves and to ourselves. Perhaps you recognize it in some way. It's actually one of the most painful things that we can carry in our hearts when we believe this story, this idea. And it's not true. To look at what it means to be a human being, we have to see, as the Buddha saw, that this is part of all of our story. It's universal. It's not just me. It's not just you. It just isn't like that. When we have the small group meetings, one of the things that people sometimes comment on, perhaps you've noticed, it's one of the things from my view, which make it really important that we have such meetings as we do in the small groups, to hear each other's experience. Because when we do, what we notice very quickly is that other people's experience is not so different than ours. Some things it is, of course, but in other things, actually it's very similar, and we can recognize elements of ourselves in each other when we speak about what is real, when we speak about what is true. And when we see that this is so, I think it becomes harder to believe that it's because somehow I have done it wrong, or it's my fault, or everyone else is somehow doing it well and got it figured out and just cruising along, having a nice time, which is sort of what we show the world. It's what we learned to show the world quite early on. But I'm okay, yeah, I'm fine, it's alright, nothing bothering me. Yeah? And it's not true. The Buddha spoke about this in a way that when I first heard it, I remember feeling a real sense of just the truth and the relief of it. And he spoke about the fact that we all are touched in these ways that are difficult, that are challenging for us. You know, and he spoke about birth, aging, sickness and death as the journey of our bodies. It doesn't sound very much like fun, does it? And it's not somehow that to look and, oh gosh, it's just bad news. But it's kind of like, oh yeah, we all go through this journey. And he talked about the emotional or the felt experiences of sorrow, pain, grief, lamentation and despair. And it sounds like, oh, so that sounds, you know these words? Lamentation is like crying, for something that we've lost or that we feel grief for. And when I hear this, you say, oh, it doesn't sound like what I came to a meditation retreat for, you know, sort of aging, sickness, pain, grief. That's not on the retreat description. It talks about peace and happiness. And we think that's what we're here to get in a way. And yet to understand that we are all brothers and sisters in this. That includes, of course, that which is lovely and beautiful. But for that which is challenging and difficult, we need to see we are brothers and sisters in this. It's not just you or me or someone else. It's all of us. And, you know, if you still think, even though you hear me, you don't maybe have to believe me. I'm not trying to talk you into this. But you think, no, if I did it right, then there wouldn't be so much suffering. For sure, I could have a life that didn't have any pain in it. Someone must have done it by now, and maybe it should have been me. This is a contemplation I find useful. If you live in this world and you love something or someone, at some point you will be separated from it, this person or thing, because circumstances will change. Somebody or yourself, the life will not go forever. Or by accident or by choice, paths will separate. And this will be painful. If we love something in this life, we will experience pain in relationship to it. And if you don't love something in this life, this will be painful. It'll be painful. I can't see a third option. If we have a human heart, by the very fact that it can love, it hurts when it's not able to. And it hurts when it does, when it is able to, and we have the sweetness of that loving, but that it cannot stay in contact with what it loves forever. This is the nature of it. The sweetness is of equal depth to the sorrow. In the presence of sweetness, in the loss of sorrow. And this is the story of our heart. It's a beautiful, precious capacity we have as human beings. There is nothing wrong with this. And nothing wrong with us that we feel this. And so, when I speak of this and reflect on this, for me it's very much about an invitation to understand that, as I said, it's not your fault that your life is as it is. To actually forgive ourselves. To not blame ourselves. In one way this might seem simple, but in fact it's a really sometimes challenging but really important undertaking to resolve, to orient towards for our lives. To forgive others, to forgive ourselves for how life is. Because the beauty of life is woven together with its tenderness. The sweetness of loving contact is woven together with the painful tenderness and tearing sorrow of the loss or the absence of what we love. They come together so closely woven that they cannot be separated. And much of our struggle, much of our battle with life is in the idea that somehow these could be separated and we could just have one and not the other. Our life and our practice asks us to embrace both, to include both. And in this, to forgive ourselves for those places where we perhaps are struggling still, are learning still. The places where we make mistakes. You know, there's something really funny that happens to most of us. This is strange having a microphone here, because I know if I look around, you can't hear me? And normally I like to look around, so I'm just going to look around for a moment. I like to see the people here. It's lovely. I always think I have a much better deal than you, because I get to look at you and you have to look at me. You have no choice. So I rather like that. But in terms of what it is to live in this world, there's something very funny that happens to us, which is we think, or we're told, or we somehow come to believe that by the time we're about 18 or 20, we should have learned how to live our life, and everything from there on we should get it right. Maybe that starts even earlier. You know, when we're 6, it's okay to make mistakes, get it wrong, we have to learn something. 10, probably, 12, I think so, I hope so. But sometime after that, and it seems to be getting earlier, the room in our life to learn and to play seems to disappear into the idea that now I should know and get it right every time. And yet, it's just not true. It's just not true. We learn through making mistakes. And there's a story, another I like to tell stories, you might have noticed, at least sometimes they seem to speak very well to things that are important. And the story involves a Zen student who practiced Zen meditation for many years in a very strict tradition where the Zen master was very much loved and respected, but they were also all a bit scared of the master. And yet the student has the opportunity to go and meet for the first time the master and ask a question or two. And he's quite excited, but also a little scared, and he goes along. And the Zen master, she is sitting upright. And she looks very stern and looks at him, not as if she is friendly, but her eyes are bright. And he says, "Master, Master, can you tell me what's the most important thing to cultivate?" She looks at him, discernment, good judgment. You know this word discernment? Like to be able to know what is skillful and what is not. Or good judgment, we could say. Good judgment. Oh, thank you, Master. Yes, yes, of course, of course. Can you tell, how do you develop good judgment and discernment? Experience. Of course, of course. Master, how do you get experience? Bad judgment. Isn't it like this for us? Isn't it like this for us? If we see our life in this way, for me what I notice, there's just a softness that it brings. How else can we learn? How else do we grow? Except by that we try things out. We do the best we can from what we've understood and learned so far. And we see sometimes we haven't quite yet learned all of what we need to learn. And we have the opportunity to be grateful for that. Rather than disappointed or judging of ourselves. To see, this is how we grow. This is how we learn meditation. We can't tell you how to do it. It's a funny thing. If we could, we'd write it down, hand it out, we'd all read it. Oh yes, done, go home. We can only learn it ourselves, each of us. And to give ourselves the space to learn, we must have room for making mistakes. And we must have room to allow that to happen without judging or blaming or being hard on ourselves. The Buddha once encountered some of his students arguing with each other, being very cruel, and he said to them, having first told them to stop, he said, "Knowing that you will die, how can you quarrel like this? It's like knowing we're not here forever, that we're just here a little while. How can you be so cruel to each other?" And the same really applies for ourselves. Knowing that we're not here forever, how is it that we are sometimes so hard, so harsh towards ourselves? If we look with care at all that we do, and we can look for ourselves, this is something I do for myself, my own practice, regularly, to stop and contemplate where at the heart of it all does my intention come from? What is it that moves me to do anything at all? And if you look carefully, I think you'll find, you'll see that in fact, in the end, it always comes from the wish somehow to take care of that which I care about. Sometimes it's just to take care of me. Sometimes it's to take care of something else. But it's always coming out of a wish to take care of. Now, sometimes I understand well how to do that. Sometimes, clearly, I have no idea at all, and it doesn't necessarily produce the result that what I wish to take care of is taken care of. But the heart of it comes from that caring. The heart of everything that moves in this world comes only and always because there is caring. Caring is innate and fundamental to what it is that we are. What we don't necessarily have is the wisdom to accompany it, to know how to express that caring in the world in a way that is skillful, in a way that truly contributes to well-being for ourselves, for each other, for our world. So this is a significant, perhaps we could say even the most fundamental element of the journey of our awakening, is the developing of this wisdom that can be harnessed together with the love. But also there must be the recognizing, the seeing, the honoring of the love that is already there. Nothing moves except from this. It might be that by the time it appears in action, we can't see where it came from anymore. Because through fear and through need comes a blindness where we stop seeing and others stop seeing fully the effect of our actions, because all we can see is me and what I need, or what I'm afraid of. And if someone else can only see what they think they need, or what they're afraid of. This is the human condition. And of course we need to take real care to be able to see where there is something harmful or unskillful, to say no, stop. Whether it be the behavior of someone else in the world, or whether it be our own tendency of the mind to come up and judge or blame or be critical or cruel to ourselves, blaming and judging. To actually care for this precious human being that we are is an essential part of our practice. And I'd like to read you a piece by an Indian practitioner and teacher, a monk, Kirupil Vananji. He said, "Break your heart no longer. Each time you judge yourself, you break your heart. You stop feeding on the love that is the wellspring of your vitality. But now the time has come, your time, to live, to celebrate, and to see the goodness that you are. There is no evil, no wrong, in you or in any other. There is only the thought of it, and the thought has no substance. You are dear, divine, and very, very pure. Let no one, no thing, no idea or ideal obstruct you. Even if one comes in the name of truth, forgive the thought for its unknowing. Do not fight it. Just let go and breathe into the goodness that you are. To breathe into the goodness that we are. What would it mean to trust that possibility? To understand and know that at the very heart of our hearts. We all deeply long for happiness and for well-being. And when we're not feeling under pressure or threat with that, we naturally, easily, and organically wish it for each other too. This practice asks us to open again and again, to allow ourselves to be touched deeply by what is here, and to allow in that, in being touched, we become open to the movement of life, to the flow of what is moving around us, what is moving through us, that comes in so many different flavors, so many different colors, so many different textures, some of them sweet and delicious, some of them raw or harsh, some of them kind of ordinary, and it seems insignificant, but all of them part of the flow and the movement of life. That when we resist and push away, or when we grasp hold of and cling to, it's like that movement gets checked, gets blocked, gets stopped, and there's a kind of a stagnating. You know this word? When water cannot flow and it becomes unhealthy? That we're learning to allow the movement. We don't have to make the movement happen, but becoming aware of the ways in which we resist, we hold, we allow things to move, and what we experience as something solid and fixed, boundaried and hard, and therefore also vulnerable to being harmed or hurt, we start to know more and more as something fluid, as something open, as something that is dynamic rather than fixed. And in that, what we might perhaps say is that the heart starts to know its openness more fully. Our heart is never fully closed, or we would be dead. But in fact, the back door closes. So the front door of the heart is always open. It's the back door that closes and things get stuck. So when we talk about opening our hearts, in a way it's the opening to the allowing of life as it is, to move, to flow as it does. That when it passes through, the front is open and the back door too, when life is allowed to pass through, we start to sense, we start to know something of an okayness. An okayness. Whether the sense of something wrong, of not okay, in me, or in life, or in others, somehow drops away. There's something in the movement, there's something in the fluidity of life that can speak to us, that can let us know, that can inform us at the level of our heart of something that has a suchness, that has a fullness and a completeness to it, independent of what it is that we're meeting, that we're handling, that we're working with in this moment. And we start to trust this heart's capacity to be open to our life, to hold and to allow our life to transform within us. The fear from when we were young, from when we were little, that we cannot handle what is presented, that is born of something that is no longer the truth. And the truth here is that we have much greater capacity than we imagine. And that when we open, when we allow ourselves to feel the aliveness, the fluidity, to embrace it with kindness, that there is a natural opening into the peaceful dimension, we could say, of life, which is that which is shared amongst all beings, all of life, something in which we are not separate from and cannot be apart from everything that is, and that we can know this in our hearts. And in this, our heart's natural response to life is to find the ways that it can care for and to deepen in the wisdom that allows us to care skillfully, to express that caring in a way that truly contributes, in a way that truly benefits our life and the life of others and all around us. And so there's both a movement and an offering, a natural offering of care that is expressed. And at the same time, as that movement flows, there's a coming to rest. The heart comes to rest at the same time as it finds its natural movement. In the openness, in the fullness, in the undividedness of what it is that we are, what it is that we've always been, that we can never become distant from, and yet which we are in a journey of coming to understand more fully and more deeply. Not with our minds, not with our ideas, but with the very heart and cells of our body and our life. And it's this that our practice is concerned with. It's this that our life, at the heart of it, is concerned with. So let's sit quietly for a few moments together. So may we all, through our practice here together and in our lives, may we deepen in our capacity to touch our heart and our world with kindness. And may we equally learn and deepen in our capacity to rest in the open heart of life. To know peace and freedom in the midst of all things, for our own welfare and for the welfare of all beings. So please continue with your practice, and we have the next sitting again at 10 minutes to 9. Thank you.